The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 24. The Killing of the Divine King. Section 3. Kings killed at the end of a fixed term. I end the cases hitherto described. The divine king or priest is suffered by his people to retain office until some outward defect, some visible symptom of failing health or advancing age, warns them that he is no longer equal to the discharge of his divine duties. But not until such symptoms have made their appearance is he put to death. Some peoples, however, appear to have thought it unsafe to wait for even the slightest symptom of decay and have preferred to kill the king while he was still in the full vigor of life. Accordingly, they have fixed a term beyond which he might not reign, and at the close of which he must die, the term fixed upon being short enough to exclude the probability of his degenerating physically in the interval. In some parts of southern India the period fixed was 12 years. Thus, according to an old traveller, in the province of Koilakere, there is a Gentile house of prayer, in which there is an idol which they hold in great account, and every 12 years they celebrate a great feast to it, whither all the Gentiles goes to a jubilee. This temple possesses many lands and much revenue, it is a very great affair. This province has a king over it, who has not more than 12 years to reign from jubilee to jubilee. His manner of living is in this wise, that is to say, when the 12 years are completed, on the day of this feast there assemble together innumerable people, and much money is spent in giving food to Brahmins. The king has a wooden scaffolding made, spread over with silken hangings, and on that day he goes to bathe at a tank with great ceremonies and sound of music. After that he comes to the idol and prays to it, and mounts onto the scaffolding. And there before all the people he takes some very sharp knives, and begins to cut off his nose, and then his ears, and his lips, and all his members, and as much flesh off himself as he can. And he throws it away very hurriedly until so much of his blood is spilled that he begins to faint, and then he cuts his throat himself. And he performs this sacrifice to the idol. And whoever desires to reign another 12 years and undertake this martyrdom for love of the idol, has to be present looking on at this, and from that place they raise him up as king. The king of Calicut, on the Malabar coast, bears the title of Samorin or Samari. He pretends to be of a higher rank than the Brahmins, and to be inferior only to the invisible gods. A pretension that was acknowledged by his subjects, but which is held as absurd and abominable by the Brahmins, by whom he is only treated as a Sudra. Formerly the Samorin had to cut his throat in public at the end of a 12 years reign. But towards the end of the 17th century the rule had been modified as follows: many strange customs were observed in this country in former times, and some very odd ones are still continued. It was an ancient custom for the Samorin to reign but 12 years, and no longer. If he died before his term was expired, it saved him a troublesome ceremony of cutting his own throat, on a public scaffold erected for the purpose. He first made a feast for all his nobility and gentry, who are very numerous. After the feast he saluted his guests, and went on the scaffold, and very decently cut his own throat in the view of the assembly, and his body was, a little while after, burned with great pomp and ceremony, and the grandees elected a new Samorin. Whether that custom was a religious or a civil ceremony, I know not, but it is now laid aside. And a new custom is followed by the modern Samorins, that jubilee is proclaimed throughout his dominions, at the end of 12 years, and a tent is pitched for him in a spacious plain, and a great feast is celebrated for 10 or 12 days, with mirth and jollity, guns firing night and day. So at the end of the feast any 4 of the guests that have a mind to gain a crown by a desperate action, in fighting their way through 30 or 40,000 of his guards, and kill the Samorin in his tent, he that kills him succeeds him in his empire. In anno 1695, one of those jubilees happened, and the tent pitched near Penny, a seaport of his, about 15 leagues to the southward of Calicut. There were but 3 men that would venture on that desperate action, who fell in, with sword and target, among the guard, and, after they had killed and wounded many, were themselves killed. One of the desperados had a nephew of 15 or 16 years of age, that kept close by his uncle in the attack on the guards, and, when he saw him fall, the youth got through the guard into the tent, and made a stroke at his majesty's head, and had certainly dispatched him if a large brass lamp which was burning over his head had not marred the blow. But, before he could make another, he was killed by the guards. And, I believe, the same Samorin reigns yet. I chanced to come that time along the coast and heard the guns for 2 or 3 days and nights successively. The English traveller, whose account I have quoted, did not himself witness the festival he describes, though he heard the sound of the firing in the distance. Fortunately, exact records of these festivals and of the number of men who perished at them have been preserved in the archives of the royal family at Calicut. In the latter part of the 19th century they were examined by Mr. W. Logan, with the personal assistance of the reigning king, and from his work it is possible to gain an accurate conception both of the tragedy and of the scene where it was periodically enacted down to 1743, when the ceremony took place for the last time. The festival at which the King of Calicut staked his crown and his life on the issue of battle was known as the Great Sacrifice. It fell every 12th year, when the planet Jupiter was in retrograde motion in the sign of the Crab, and it lasted 28 days, culminating at the time of the 8th lunar asterism in the month of Macharam. As the date of the festival was determined by the position of Jupiter in the sky, and the interval between two festivals was 12 years, which is roughly Jupiter's period of revolution round the sun, we may conjecture that the splendid planet was supposed to be in a special sense the king's star and to rule his destiny, the period of its revolution in heaven corresponding to the period of his reign on earth. However that may be, the ceremony was observed with great pomp at the Terunavai temple, on the north bank of the Bonani River. The spot is close to the present railway line. As the train rushes by, you can just catch a glimpse of the temple, almost hidden behind a clump of trees on the river bank. From the western gateway of the temple a perfectly straight road, hardly raised above the level of the surrounding rice fields and shaded by a fine avenue, runs for half a mile to a high ridge with a precipitous bank, on which the outlines of 3 or 4 terraces can still be traced. On the topmost of these terraces the king took his stand on the eventful day. The view which it commands is a fine one. Across the flat expanse of the rice fields, with the broad placid river winding through them, the eye ranges eastward to high Dable lands, their lower slopes embowered in woods, while afar off looms the great chain of the Western Ghauts, and in the furthest distance the Neil Kerries or Blue Mountains, hardly distinguishable from the azure of the sky above. But it was not to the distant prospect that the king's eyes naturally turned at this crisis of his fate. His attention was arrested by a spectacle nearer at hand. For all the plain below was alive with troops, their banners waving gaily in the sun, the white tents of their many camps standing sharply out against the green and gold of the rice fields. 40,000 fighting men or more were gathered there to defend the king. But if the plain swarmed with soldiers, the road that cuts across it from the temple to the king's stand was clear of them. Not a soul was stirring on it. Each side of the way was barred by palisades, and from the palisades on either hand a long hedge of spears, held by strong arms, projected into the empty road, their blades meeting in the middle and forming a glittering arch of steel. All was now ready. The king waved his sword. At the same moment a great chain of massy gold, enriched with bosses, was placed on an elephant at his side. That was the signal. On the instant a stir might be seen half a mile away at the gate of the temple. A group of swordsmen, decked with flowers and smeared with ashes, has stepped out from the crowd. They have just partaken of their last meal on earth, and they now receive the last blessings and farewells of their friends. A moment more and they are coming down the lane of spears, hewing and stabbing right and left at the spearmen, winding and turning and writhing among the blades as if they had no bones in their bodies. It is all in vain. One after the other they fall, some nearer the king, some farther off, content to die, not for the shadow of a crown, but for the mere sake of approving their dauntless valor and swordsmanship to the world. On the last days of the festival the same magnificent display of gallantry, the same useless sacrifice of life was repeated again and again. Yet perhaps no sacrifice is wholly useless which proves that there are men who prefer honor to life. It is a singular custom in Bengal, says an old native historian of India, that there is little of hereditary descent in succession to the sovereignty. Whoever kills the king, and succeeds in placing himself on that throne, is immediately acknowledged as king. All the emirs, wazirs, soldiers, and peasants instantly obey and submit to him, and consider him as being as much their sovereign as they did their former prince, and obey his orders implicitly. The people of Bengal say, "We are faithful to the throne. Whoever fills the throne, we are obedient and true to it." Single quote. A custom of the same sort formerly prevailed in the little kingdom of Passier, on the northern coast of Sumatra. The old Portuguese historian De Barros, who informs us of it, remarks with surprise that no wise man would wish to be king of Passier, since the monarch was not allowed by his subjects to live long. From time to time a sort of fury seized the people, and they marched through the streets of the city chanting with loud voices the fatal words, "The king must die." When the king heard that song of death he knew that his hour had come. The man who struck the fatal blow was of the royal lineage, and as soon as he had done the deed of blood and seated himself on the throne he was regarded as the legitimate king, provided that he contrived to maintain his seat peaceably for a single day. This, however, the Rajarshi did not always succeed in doing. When Fernão Pérez de Andrade, on a voyage to China, put in at Passier for a cargo of spices, two kings were massacred, and that in the most peaceable and orderly manner, without the smallest sign of tumult or sedition in the city, where everything went on in its usual course, as if the murder or execution of a king were a matter of everyday occurrence. Indeed, on one occasion three kings were raised to the dangerous elevation and followed each other in the dusty road of death in a single day. The people defended the custom, which they esteemed very laudable and even of divine institution, by saying that God would never allow so high and mighty a being as a king, who reigns as his vicegerent on earth, to perish by violence unless for his sins he thoroughly deserved it. Far away from the tropical island of Sumatra a rule of the same sort appears to have obtained among the old Slavs. When the captive's gun and charm Eric contrived to slay the king and queen of the Slavs and made their escape, they were pursued by the barbarians, who shouted after them that if they would only come back they would reign instead of the murdered monarch, since by a public statute of the ancients the succession to the throne fell to the king's assassin. But the flying Rajarshis turned a deaf ear to promises which they regarded as mere baits to lure them back to destruction. They continued their flight, and the shouts and clamor of the barbarians gradually died away in the distance. When kings were bound to suffer death, whether at their own hands or at the hands of others, on the expiration of a fixed term of years, it was natural that they should seek to delegate the painful duty, along with some of the privileges of sovereignty, to a substitute who should suffer vicariously in their stead. This expedient appears to have been resorted to by some of the princes of Malabar. Thus we are informed by a native authority on that country that, in some places all powers both executive and judicial were delegated for a fixed period to natives by the sovereign. This institution was styled Thalavatipathyam or authority obtained by decapitation. It was an office tenable for 5 years during which its bearer was invested with supreme despotic powers within his jurisdiction. On the expiry of the 5 years the man's head was cut off and thrown up in the air amongst a large concourse of villagers, each of whom vied with the other in trying to catch it in its course down. He who succeeded was nominated to the post for the next 5 years. When once kings, who had hitherto been bound to die a violent death at the end of a term of years, conceived the happy thought of dying by deputy in the persons of others, they would very naturally put it in practice. And accordingly we need not wonder at finding so popular an expedient, or traces of it, in many lands. Scandinavian traditions contain some hints that of old the Swedish kings reigned only for periods of 9 years, after which they were put to death or had to find a substitute to die in their stead. Thus Onarin, king of Sweden, is said to have sacrificed to Odin for a length of days and to have been answered by the god that he should live so long as he sacrificed one of his sons every 9th year. He sacrificed 9 of them in this manner, and would have sacrificed the 10th and last, but the Swedes would not allow him. So he died and was buried in a mound at Uppsala. Another indication of a similar tenure of the crown occurs in a curious legend of the deposition and banishment of Odin. Offended at his misdeeds, the other gods outlawed and exiled him, but set up in his place a substitute, Euler by name, a cunning wizard, to whom they accorded the symbols both of royalty and of godhead. The deputy bore the name of Odin, and reigned for nearly 10 years, when he was driven from the throne, while the real Odin came to his own again. His discomfited rival retired to Sweden and was afterwards slain in an attempt to repair his shattered fortunes. As gods are often merely men who loom large through the mists of tradition, we may conjecture that this Norse legend preserves a confused reminiscence of ancient Swedish kings who reigned for 9 or 10 years together, then abdicated, delegating to others the privilege of dying for their country. The great festival which was held at Uppsala every 9 years may have been the occasion on which the king or his deputy was put to death. We know that human sacrifices formed part of the rites. There are some grounds for believing that the reign of many ancient Greek kings was limited to 8 years, or at least that at the end of every period of 8 years a new consecration, a fresh outpouring of the divine grace, was regarded as necessary in order to enable them to discharge their civil and religious duties. Thus it was a rule of the Spartan constitution that every 8th year the ephors should choose a clear and moonless night and sitting down observe the sky in silence. If during their vigil they saw a meteor or shooting star, they inferred that the king had sinned against the deity, and they suspended him from his functions until the Delphic or Olympic oracle should reinstate him in them. This custom, which has all the air of great antiquity, was not suffered to remain a dead letter even in the last period of the Spartan monarchy. For in the 3rd century before our era, a king, who had rendered himself obnoxious to the reforming party, was actually deposed on various trumped-up charges, among which the allegation that the ominous sign had been seen in the sky took a prominent place. If the tenure of the regal office was formerly limited among the Spartans to 8 years, we may naturally ask, why was that precise period selected as the measure of a king's reign? The reason is probably to be found in those astronomical considerations which determined the early Greek calendar. The difficulty of reconciling lunar with solar time is one of the standing puzzles which has taxed the ingenuity of men who are emerging from barbarism. Now an octennial cycle is the shortest period at the end of which sun and moon really mark time together after overlapping, so to say, throughout the whole of the interval. Thus, for example, it is only once in every 8 years that the full moon coincides with the longest or shortest day. And as this coincidence can be observed with the aid of a simple dial, the observation is naturally one of the first to furnish a base for a calendar which shall bring lunar and solar times into tolerable, though not exact, harmony. But in early days the proper adjustment of the calendar is a matter of religious concern, since on it depends the knowledge of the right seasons for propitiating the deities whose favor is indispensable to the welfare of the community. No wonder, therefore, that the king, as the chief priest of the state, or as himself a god, should be liable to deposition or death at the end of an astronomical period. When the great luminaries had run their course on high, and were about to renew the heavenly race, it might well be thought that the king should renew his divine energies, or prove them unabated, under pain of making room for a more vigorous successor. In southern India, as we have seen, The king's reign and life terminated with the revolution of the planet Jupiter around the sun. In Greece, on the other hand, the king's fate seems to have hung in the balance at the end of every 8 years, ready to fly up and kick the beam as soon as the opposite scale was loaded with a falling star. Whatever its origin may have been, the cycle of 8 years appears to have coincided with the normal length of the king's reign in other parts of Greece besides Sparta. Thus Minos, king of Knossos in Crete, whose great palace has been unearthed in recent years, is said to have held office for periods of 8 years together. At the end of each period he retired for a season to the Oracular cave on Mount Ida, and there communed with his divine father Zeus, giving him an account of his kingship in the years that were past, and receiving from him instructions for his guidance in those which were to come. The tradition plainly implies that at the end of every 8 years the king's sacred powers needed to be renewed by intercourse with the Godhead, and that without such a renewal he would have forfeited his right to the throne. Without being unduly rash, we may surmise that the tribute of 7 youths and 7 maidens whom the Athenians were bound to send to Minos every 8 years had some connection with the renewal of the king's power for another octennial cycle. Traditions vary as to the fate which awaited the lads and damsels on their arrival in Crete. But the common view appears to have been that they were shut up in the labyrinth, there to be devoured by the Minotaur, or at least to be imprisoned for life. Perhaps they were sacrificed by being roasted alive in a bronze image of a bull, or of a bull-headed man, in order to renew the strength of the king and of the sun, whom he personated. This at all events is suggested by the legend of Talus, a bronze man who clutched people to his breast and leaped with them into the fire, so that they were roasted alive. He is said to have been given by Zeus to Europa, or by Hephaestus to Minos, to guard the island of Crete, which he patrolled thrice daily. According to one account he was a bull, according to another he was the sun. Probably he was identical with the Minotaur, and stripped of his mythical features was nothing but a bronze image of the sun represented as a man with a bull's head. In order to renew the solar fires, human victims may have been sacrificed to the idol by being roasted in its hollow body or placed on its sloping hands and allowed to roll into a pit of fire. It was in the latter fashion that the Carthaginians sacrificed their offspring to Moloch. The children were laid on the hands of a calf-headed image of bronze, from which they slid into a fiery oven, while the people danced to the music of flutes and timbrels to drown the shrieks of the burning victims. The resemblance which the Cretan traditions bear to the Carthaginian practice suggests that the worship associated with the names of Minos and the Minotaur may have been powerfully influenced by that of a Semitic Baal. In the tradition of Phalaris, tyrant of Agrigentum, and his brazen bull, we may have an echo of similar rites in Sicily, where the Carthaginian power struck deep roots. In the province of Lagos, the Ijebu tribe of the Yoruba race is divided into 2 branches, which are known respectively as the Ijebu Ode and the Ijebu Remen. The Ode branch of the tribe is ruled by a chief who bears the title of Awajale and is surrounded by a great deal of mystery. Down to recent times his face might not be seen even by his own subjects, and if circumstances obliged him to communicate with them he did so through a screen which hid him from view. The other or Remen branch of the Ijebu tribe is governed by a chief, who ranks below the Awajale. Mr. John Parkinson was informed that in former times this subordinate chief used to be killed with ceremony after a rule of 3 years. As the country is now under British protection, the custom of putting the chief to death at the end of a 3 years' reign has long been abolished, and Mr. Parkinson was unable to ascertain any particulars on the subject. At Babylon, within historical times, the tenure of the kingly office was in practice lifelong, yet in theory it would seem to have been merely annual. For every year at the festival of Zagmuk the king had to renew his power by seizing the hands of the image of Marduk in his great temple of Esagil at Babylon. Even when Babylon passed under the power of Assyria, the monarchs of that country were expected to legalize their claim to the throne every year by coming to Babylon and performing the ancient ceremony at the New Year festival, and some of them found the obligation so burdensome that rather than discharge it they renounced the title of king altogether and contented themselves with the humbler one of governor. Further, it would appear that in remote times, though not within the historical period, the kings of Babylon or their barbarous predecessors forfeited not merely their crown but their life at the end of a year's tenure of office. At least this is the conclusion to which the following evidence seems to point. According to the historian Berossus, who as a Babylonian priest spoke with ample knowledge, there was annually celebrated in Babylon a festival called the Sakalia. It began on the 16th day of the month Lars, and lasted for 5 days, during which masters and servants changed places, the servants giving orders and the masters obeying them. A prisoner condemned to death was dressed in the king's robes, seated on the king's throne, allowed to issue whatever commands he pleased, to eat, drink, and enjoy himself, and to lie with the king's concubines. But at the end of the 5 days he was stripped of his royal robes, scourged, and hanged or impaled. During his brief term of office he bore the title of Zoganes. This custom might perhaps have been explained as merely a grim jest perpetrated in a season of jollity at the expense of an unhappy criminal. But one circumstance the leave given to the mock king to enjoy the king's concubines is decisive against this interpretation. Considering the jealous seclusion of an Oriental despot's harem, we may be quite certain that permission to invade it would never have been granted by the despot, least of all to a condemned criminal, except for the very gravest cause. This cause could hardly be other than that the condemned man was about to die in the king's stead, and that to make the substitution perfect it was necessary he should enjoy the full rights of royalty during his brief reign. There is nothing surprising in this substitution. The rule that the king must be put to death either on the appearance of any symptom of bodily decay or at the end of a fixed period is certainly one which, sooner or later, the kings would seek to abolish or modify. We have seen that in Ethiopia, Sofala, and Ayo the rule was boldly set aside by enlightened monarchs. And that in Calicut the old custom of killing the king at the end of 12 years was changed into a permission granted to anyone at the end of the 12 years period to attack the king, and, in the event of killing him, to reign in his stead. Though, as the king took care at these times to be surrounded by his guards, the permission was little more than a form. Another way of modifying the stern old rule is seen in the Babylonian custom just described. When the time drew near for the king to be put to death, in Babylon this appears to have been at the end of a single year's reign, he abdicated for a few days, during which a temporary king reigned and suffered in his stead. At first the temporary king may have been an innocent person, possibly a member of the king's own family. But with the growth of civilization the sacrifice of an innocent person would be revolting to the public sentiment, and accordingly a condemned criminal would be invested with a brief and fatal sovereignty. In the sequel we shall find other examples of a dying criminal representing a dying god. For we must not forget that, as the case of the Shilluk kings clearly shows, the king is slain in his character of a god or a demigod, his death and resurrection, as the only means of perpetuating the divine life unimpaired, being deemed necessary for the salvation of his people and the world. A vestige of a practice of putting the king to death at the end of a year's reign appears to have survived in the festival called Makahiti, which used to be celebrated in Hawaii during the last month of the year. About 100 years ago a Russian voyager described the custom as follows: the taboo Makahiti is not unlike to our festival of Christmas. It continues a whole month, during which the people amuse themselves with dances, plays, and sham fights of every kind. The king must open this festival wherever he is. On this occasion his majesty dresses himself in his richest cloak and helmet, and is paddled in a canoe along the shore, followed sometimes by many of his subjects. He embarks early, and must finish his excursion at sunrise. The strongest and most expert of the warriors is chosen to receive him on his landing. This warrior watches the canoe along the beach. And as soon as the king lands, and has thrown off his cloak, he darts his spear at him, from a distance of about 30 paces, and the king must either catch the spear in his hand, or suffer from it, There is no jesting in the business. Having caught it, he carries it under his arm, with the sharp end downwards, into the temple or hivu. On his entrance, the assembled multitude begin their sham fights, and immediately the air is obscured by clouds of spears, made for the occasion with blunted ends. Hamamiya left square bracket. The king right square bracket has been frequently advised to abolish this ridiculous ceremony, in which he risks his life every year. But to no effect. His answer was is, that he is as able to catch a spear as anyone on the island is to throw it at him. During the Makahiti, all punishments are remitted throughout the country. And no person can leave the place in which he commences these holidays, let the affair be ever so important. That a king should regularly have been put to death at the close of a year's reign will hardly appear improbable when we learn that to this day there is still a kingdom in which the reign and the life of the sovereign are limited to a single day. In Yoyo, a province of the ancient kingdom of Congo, the rule ordains that the chief who assumes the cap of sovereignty is always killed on the night after his coronation. The right of succession lies with the chief of the Muserongo. But we need not wonder that he does not exercise it, and that the throne stands vacant. No one likes to lose his life for a few hours' glory on the Nyoyo throne.